Hey everyone, thanks for listening to my podcasts here on the Hullerstubber feed. Do spread the word to other people if you think they might enjoy them. Do listen to some more if you think you might enjoy them, but do enjoy this one. I am shortly going to be on tour with my new stand-up show, Can I Have My Ball Back? Head to richardherring.com/ballback/tour for all those dates. Some of them are sold out, some of them have hardly sold anything. It would really help me if you bought tickets to the ones that aren't sold out. Either way, as soon as you can. I think it's going to be a lot of fun. It's about cancer and testicles. One of them's not funny, but one of them's really funny, and it kind of cancels out the unfunniness. I'd say just on average, slightly more funny. So I hope you'll come along. If not, keep enjoying the podcast. We'll be back in September at the Leicester Square Theatre with more live podcasts. Maybe a few Edinburgh ones before then. Sit back, relax, and enjoy this stupid podcast you've chosen to listen to.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. quince.com/style.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Ladies and gentlemen, please give a huge slapstick welcome to the wonderful Mr. Richard Herring!
Thank you! Oh, lovely to see you all. Hello, Bristol! How lovely to see you. Thank you very much. Welcome to the show. We're at St. George's in Bristol. Welcome to Richard Herring's loving slapstick twattery podcast. Though I was hanging around with the people who pulled down the statue of Colston the other day. They call it Hullerstubber, so I don't know if that's going to... Oh, there are some people in, that's good. Because it was sort of like a hybrid slapstick festival, the Bristol Slapstick Festival, so I'm doing a chat. But we're going to put it out as a podcast as well, so it's a little bit of both. I was talking about the Colston guys to my four-year-old son, as we were passing by the place he was thrown in, and he was very keen to jump in and see the statue in there. It's a shame you didn't leave him down there, but never mind. It's a shame, you know, people love old Colston here in Bristol. It's a shame what those guys did, isn't it? I think in the 1990s we were talking about when we played the Colston Orwell game. It's nice to see a venue funded by slavery, and it's a... But I think it's all changing now. We're not. We wouldn't go to the Colston Hall. We're at St. George's, named after St. George, who... Oh, he killed some dragons. He'd probably be in trouble these days, wouldn't he, for killing endangered species. That's it. You can't judge people by the standards of today. That's the... All right. So I just want to say briefly, this Slapstick Festival, Barry Cryer was obviously such a huge part of this festival, and... sadly, died a couple of days ago, just before we're doing this. And I was very, very lucky to know him as a friend. But also, he did do my podcast back in, I think, August or September. So we've got if you get a chance to watch or listen to that podcast, it's an amazing tribute to Barry. It's all him. He's very, very funny. And possibly, I think, his last appearance on stage, which is very... And there's a lovely bit at the end where he just waves at the audience, and it's a very fitting tribute to a great man. I just wanted to tell one story about him, one of his stories was when Stuart Lee was doing very well in Edinburgh with one of his comeback stand-up shows, and Barry went up to him in Edinburgh one night with a kind of face like thunder, and he was very cross with Stuart. Stuart said, "What's wrong with me, son? I'm very angry with you, Stuart." And Stuart was... What's happened? He was really playing this you know, I'm very angry with what you've done. And she said, what? I said, that I did that vomiting into the anus of Christ routine. I've been doing that from the 60s, since the 60s. You totally ripped me off. And knowing Stuart, I know for a second he'll have thought, oh, God, before he realised it was a joke. But that's the man. He was an incredible man. So this is a tribute to Barry, this festival, this podcast. I'd like to do that. But let's crack on. Hopefully tonight's guest won't die in the next 3 or 4 months. Hopefully, fingers crossed, let's hope not. He's probably the curse of Alastair has struck again. There's three guests down so far. Of about 350, it's not bad. One of them was Nicholas Parsons. I mean, it's common, it's not that. My guest tonight, and this afternoon, in fact, is probably best known for his appearance as Harry Taylor in Heartbeat. That's why we're all here to see him. That's where we remember him from. Will you please welcome the amazing John Coleshaw, ladies and gentlemen. Thank you very much. He's looking very healthy. He's looking very healthy. Hello, John.
Hello there, Richard.
How are you doing? Love to see you.
I remember that that part in Heartbeats.
Yeah, well, because you've done a few acting roles. I'm presuming this wasn't an impression of someone.
In a way, it was.
Was it? Okay.
It was sort of based on a younger Alan Sugar.
Okay.
That's where I based it. And also based on a producer I knew called Richard Hearsey,
okay,
who sort of spoke in a similar kind of way. So I thought, you know, a 60s entrepreneur.
Oh, good.
That might sort of hang together quite nicely.
Yeah, good. Was it Nick Berry era Heartbeats?
No, it wasn't that era. It was a few. I think Nick had regenerated into other policemen later than that. But yeah, around about 2006. Happy memories.
Yeah.
Near Goathland. In the North York Moors.
Okay.
And the pub that they used in... You see, I never expect... This is the joy of your interviews.
Right.
I never expected Heartbeat tales to emerge. But the pub that they use, the story goes that Queen Victoria and her sort of entourage, if they had entourages then, if that's the right word, they sheltered in that pub from a storm.
Okay.
And the fire was lit for her to keep Queen Victoria in a state of warmth and well-being and reassurance. And so the story goes, they've kept that fire burning, never let it go out, ever since. And filming that Heartbeat episode, it was on a very hot day and the fire was going.
So. You chucked a bucket of water over it. No, why have you done that? Look, I've been, you know, I know a lot about your career. It's always a fun thing with this show that I kind of look deeply into everything you've done, and I didn't really know where you'd sort of popped up from, because you seemed to be successful straight away, but you worked in as a DJ, right? That was your sort of first job in was it on the Hull the first
yes time? I worked in as a DJ in various nightclubs,
right?
Shades in Blackpool, where else, the Vale Royal Function Room in Oral near Wigan, next door to my sixth form college, and Hospital Radio in Ormskirk. And for some reason, this was the late 80s.
Yeah.
And at this time, all DJs had to talk in this sort of way, which is not the usual West Lancashire accent. You had all the same sort of anecdotes ready. That was level 42 and something about you, and they get their name from the world's highest car park, the top of which is level 42. So... Yes, happy DJ days.
And so I've heard you saying that there was a sort of receptionist at the radio station who kind of pushed you into performing more.
It was a little bit like that.
Yeah.
This was at Viking Radio in Hull.
Yeah.
And I think I'd been doing the afternoon show, and I would pepper the show with voices, just as a party trick, really, as a bit of temporary distraction. And I think in these days, this would have been about 1989, you know, so I would have done a lot of Frank Bruno. You know, maybe Terry Christian off the word, you know, people like that kind of thing, you know. All those sort of, like, voices of the era, you know. I sort of did, Terry Christian there, but with the motion of Paul McCartney, you know. Wasn't really meant to go that way, but hey, whatever piece, you know. And I was heading home that day, and Anne-Marie, the receptionist at Viking Radio, she was sort of like the Kylie Minogue of Hull. that she's still a friend even now, and she said in this lovely Hull accent, you know, don't waste the fact you can do all these voices, you know. Never mind talking in between Madonna records. Get an act and do what Bobby Davro does. that was a little moment when I thought.
So you took that and then started doing stand up with it.
It was certainly a moment when I thought, well, yeah, maybe I'll give that a try.
Yeah.
And one of the guys who wrote the radio adverts, a chap called Paul Sather, was also a bit of a dab hand at writing gags. Yeah. So we'd go to the pub for a few sessions, and he'd write some gags to go with my voices.
Yeah.
So I remember the gags of the time. Billy Connolly's Scottish cousin, the more the merrier. You know, think stuff like that.
Yeah.
And I'd just fashion a little three-minute act. And I did my first... We all remember our first stand-up act. And mine was at the Salt End Labour Club in near Hull. And this was a real old-school L.E. kind of compare.
Yeah.
You know, most of the time he spoke like Huey Green when he was talking to the people on the audience there at Salt End. Beautiful place, beautiful place. He had this Huey Green style about him. And then the rest of the time, he'd like go back to Hull, you know. Just like talking. He says, right, I'll introduce you. You'll come on, take Mark off me, and then you've got 10 minutes. Okay, all right. Hi there, ladies and gentlemen. Got a great act today for you. He's come from Radio Viking, just up the road. Will you please welcome Mr. Don Colstrone? And I was going through, you know, the various impersonations of John Major, Billy Connolly, Terry Christian, all the characters of the era. And he walks on stage, mid-act, yanks the microphone out of my hand.
God.
And I'm thinking, good grief, what on earth? It wasn't going that badly. You know, there was a few merry little titters. It was fine. And he yanked the microphone off me. Just to let you know, ladies and gentlemen, the onion sandwiches will be served on that trestle table tonight. Not at the usual kitchen door. Please leave the way clear. Thank you. Back to you, Don.
And so what was the break that kind of got you? You sort of moved into radio and Spitting Image and stuff. So how did you make that leap?
It was, once again, it was... I think the start was at Viking Radio. I interviewed Lenny Henry,
right,
who was performing at the new theatre at that time. And we started just having a bit of a laugh with voices, you know, back and forth and back and forth. And he was so full of energy and brilliance. And I was playing along. But he was taking the lead, and all I could do was follow in an inspired sort of way. And he said, why don't you send a tape to Spitting Image? They're always looking for people.
Right.
So I did. I started writing down my various voices, and then pinching a little bit of studio time in the studio where they used to make the adverts, and clicking them onto a cassette, bit by bit by bit, and then just sending them off.
Yeah.
And I think I posted about 2 tapes off a few months apart. And the second time was when Steve Coogan had moved on from Spitting Image, and that left a gap. That was when Alistair McGowan and myself joined the team.
Yeah.
So, yeah, Spitting Image was... That was my first sort of appointment on TV.
And you did John Major, so you did that was one of the pretty big names for that era.
Sometimes Alistair did him, sometimes I did.
But yes, sir, he was. We would never sort of see the puppet, but you had to just remember this puppet, you know, the colour of blue tech in your mind.
And Alistair made an observation that... one of those voices.
John Major was one of those voices. It's very easy. Don't push it too much or he goes into Michael Caine.
Which is probably how he should have conducted his entire career.
I guess because I was writing for Spitting Image around about that time. I don't know if... me and Stuart were writing together, and we sent off a few sketches, but we got a couple on, but they weren't... It was all about Mr. Kipling's cakes. That was a sort of runner that I managed to get on about. Bill Dare was the producer, because we sent in we just as a joke to Bill Dare, who was the producer, and who produces Dead Ringers as well. We wrote a sketch called Bill Dare's Bottom, which was... So it was a pun on Builder's Bottom, but it was basically just his bottom appearing in the sky. And we sent in this script, and I don't think he ever commented on it amongst all the scripts of John Major's.
I think he would have appreciated that.
I think he would have done.
I think, you know, I think Bill, you know, Bill Dare, he talks like this, okay? You know, if ever I am, you know, some sort of omnipotent being, you know, I will my arse will fill the sky. That's how I'm going to do it.
He would have appreciated that, I'm sure.
That's great. And, well, people are sort of fascinated with the art of being an impressionist. And it's sort of, people sort of ask you how. I mean, I can't do voices at all. I tried to do Robert De Niro's as a visual impression. That's all I've got. But it's sort of acute. I mean, there's obviously that you've got to have that skill. You must have found you had that skill. Usually people are quite young at school and find they've got the skill of mimicry. But then it's the observational aspect of it that's putting in the work, I guess, isn't it? Is that the main...
Yes, I suppose so. I think it starts with a love of character and just the quirks that people have. And when I was growing up in Lancashire, I was surrounded by all of these wonderful people like that. And I was just sort of drawn to it. And I loved to listen and see what was going on. And then I'd love to go and demonstrate this to my parents or my brother and sister. And so many local characters. My grandmother's cleaner, Mrs. Jump, you know. I noticed that, you know, she had a little rattle at the back of her throat. There, you know, that sort of a, yes, yes. That brings back happy memories. She used to say, the way I hoover your grandmother's front room carpet is the patterns are in blocks, so I hoover around like that, gradually getting smaller and smaller, a bit like the opening titles to Kojak, you know, like that. And I just love all these characters, and I'd just copy them.
Yeah.
And part of it would be instinctive, and part of it is looking for the bits you can stretch to make funny.
Yeah.
Or just capture their lovability somehow. And you just build it together. It builds out like a crystal forming, something like that.
Yeah, I mean it's sort of extraordinary. And when you listen to it, you go, it is an amazing thing to be able to change your voice that much. The thing I wonder, which is quite a technical thing again, is you know when I hear my own voice back, I don't sound like I think I sound. Mm-hmm. So even though you're listening to people, but then how do you overcome the fact that your own voice to you doesn't sound the same as it does coming out?
Yeah, I think a big help with that is that we record so much with headphones on through the mic.
Right.
So you do get to hear
right. How
it is.
Yeah.
And when you've done that for a certain amount of time, the two sounds just merge into one and you don't really notice the difference too much.
Right.
You become equally familiar and they just blur together. Maybe the brain just works it out.
Yeah.
The left-hand view and the right-hand view, and it forms like that.
Great.
I think that's how it works, really.
Cool. Yeah, I mean, it's fascinating, but also it's annoying because you've got a skill. I think that's cheating. But I have no skills. I've just got to try and be funny, and I'm not that good at that either. And you've got, like, this skill that you can just literally just do anything, can't you? Because I saw you doing To Be or Not To Be and just changing all the voices, and it's brilliant, but you don't even have to write that. William Shakespeare's written that for you. Yeah. All you've got to do is put on the phone. All you've got to do, it's easy. If I could do the voices, yes. It would be easy.
I know, I'm doing it now. I'm bothering Paul O'Grady right now because it sort of matches the theme of what we're talking about. Swanning in here with all your funny voices, doing your party tricks. So, you know, so you can't tap dance, you can't paint, you can't do that. Yeah.
But no, it's like magic, though, isn't it? Because it's you know, the ones... The really good ones, you go, that could just be them. You know, there's the ones that are sort of caricatures and fun and silly, but then sometimes I was listening to Brian Cox, and I was going, well, you could just have got Brian Cox into the studio and taken the day off and said, I'll just say this, Brian. It's that close. It's so impressive.
I have done that at times, you know, if they've... if they've done a commentary and then they've had to go, and then there's been a little word that's, you know, not quite right... And you just sort of say it and they stitch it in. And no one would ever know. It's not part of the cosmic microwave background. And Brian Cox is a very useful character to do because it takes up time. That's why an episode of Wonders of the Universe can go on for 60 minutes when it's just been walking across a few deserts and going, crab nebula. Whereas Patrick Moore on The Sky at Night, speaking much more quickly. That's why every episode of The Sky at Night lasted 20 minutes and then the news was on.
But astronomy is one of your lifelong interests, right? So it's great that you only... there's a few things that you would make it maybe come to, but... so were you into astronomy, like, before The Voices or as a child as well?
Interestingly enough, it happened the same week.
Right.
The same day, the same afternoon. I was off school with German measles, I think, one of those fashionable conditions of the 1970s. And I was watching the schools and colleges programmes on BBC Two in the afternoon. I used to love watching those, you know, Watch and Living in a Developing Country and Maths Scene, whatever the programmes were. And eventually, at the end of the schools and colleges programmes, there was a repeat of The Sky at Night. And there was Patrick Moore, instantly very, very eccentric, instantly very, very fascinating, one eye open, one eye closed, talking about very fascinating subjects indeed. Comet Aaron Rowland, total solar eclipses, the most spectacular phenomenon in all of nature. And I was just gripped by this intriguing character and what he was talking about. So it sort of spawned an interest in astronomy and added to the interest in voices and characters. Later that week, I watched the Mike Yarwood show for the first time,
okay.
Which just compounded the whole thing.
Yeah.
And that combined with just the love of all the local characters anyway, Charlie James and the aforementioned Mrs. Jump. It's around about 1975 or 1976 all this was going on.
All came together. Mm. And you sort of travel around the world for you to see, you've been to see solar eclipses around the world and that sort of thing.
Oh, yes.
Yeah.
I am an eclipse chaser.
Are you?
I am an eclipse chaser and they are, they're dramatic. They really, really are. I'll never forget the 2015 one, which was in the area of the Faroe Islands. And a group of us travelled on a ship to go and see that. And the weather was just absolutely pristine. We were seeing all the wonderful Arctic Circle mountains and geographical features and these crystal blue skies. And it was absolutely amazing. I think, well, this is perfect eclipse weather. What a sight this is going to be. The morning of the eclipse, look through the window, it's fully overcast and snowing. And your heart really does sink.
Sure.
It absolutely drops out of you, and you just... you almost want to headbutt the weather. But we were lucky, because with us was some brilliant astronomers, Pete Lawrence and Dr. Paul Abel from The Sky at Night. And they had a good rapport with the ship's captain, Captain Kjeldsen. And they'd been talking the night before about the weather, and Pete had seen on his satellite imagery thing that there was a potential gap if we steered the ship and went that away.
Wow, okay.
So the captain said, right, yes, it must have been like the bridge of the Enterprise in there. Turn the ship around. And so we could feel it, almost like a handbrake turn of the ship that night. And Dr. Paul Abel was next to a couple called Colin and Celia, and the very thin wall in the cabin, he could hear all their conversations. And as the ship was turning into choppy seas, he heard the sound of a sliding glass and a smash and someone saying, oh, Christ, me teeth. But sure enough, following Pete Lawrence's lead, once it was about 10 o'clock, the clouds began to just... there were cracks appearing. Then they widened.
Wow.
And then by the time of the total solar eclipse, the totality, which I think was about 10 past 10 that morning, it was as if the clouds parted like the waters of the Red Sea, and there was the total solar eclipse. And it was just flabbergasting. It's a very eerie alien light, a total solar eclipse.
Right.
You don't get it in any other circumstances on Earth. Different to, you know, the morning twilight or that sort of leaden look you get around the time of a thunderstorm. It's deeply eerie, and the clockwork of the solar system. It's a wonderful thing.
Well, it's easy to forget, and I suppose because many of us live in places where the light is so bright all the time that you don't. In fact, even this morning, my daughter came, and I remember staying at my parents' house in Cheddar. And my daughter came and woke me up and said, I want to show you something beautiful. And she opened the curtains and there were just lots of stars, you know. But it reminds you of how incredible it is when you see that and you see you know, the other day she showed me one Stalin's guy at our house, and she opened this, and there, you know, this sort of early morning beautiful skyscape of yes. stars. Yeah, so it is. It's a wonderful thing. It's a well, that's great to have an interest that takes you out around the world. I suppose the yeah. other thing about what you're saying, though, the bit that you can. You, with great power comes great responsibility in terms of being able to do other people, because presumably you know, you could do adverts in other people's voices, and of course you have famously, you know, tricked people with your voices. The most famous one being with Tony Blair, I suppose.
Oh yes. It was this was the time when I was working with Steve Penk at Capital Radio, yeah. and he'd been famous for. Doing these comedy phone calls for a long time, where he'd say, hello, yes, I'm calling from the council, yes, hello. And he'd sort of take on this, like a Mancunian John Cleese persona, and just sort of hammer down the door and just get people going, and then everyone would be laughing at the end of it when he revealed what was going on. And whenever he needed a character voice, then he'd bring me in, and it was wonderful working with him. It was, you know, to contribute to Capital Radio in that way was terrific. And there was one time I said, you know, this William Hague fellow, you know, he might be good for such a distinctive voice. He might be quite good for some calls. And Steve, who always saw the most direct way through to anything, he said, right, well, then we've got to call Downing Street. Okay. Are you sure? Yes! Where else? We will call Downing Street. So we thought, well, how might this conversation go? So we just had a bit of jotter paper, and yes, hello, it's William Hay. Can I speak to Tony, please? And obviously the switchboard will say, oh, go away, stop wasting our time, go away. And then we can get a nice gag with Hay saying, how dare you? I am the leader of the opposition. Am I not important enough to be put through? This is an outrage. So, right, okay. But we'll go with that. You can. So Steve got the number of the Cabinet Office from Directory Inquiries. Gentler, more trusting times. And he dials the number in. I'm there with the headphones ready to go, and the phone begins to ring. Hello, Downing Street.
Yes, hello, it's William Hague. I wonder if I could speak to Tony, please.
Yes, just a moment. Steve's bouncing up and down on his studio swivel chair, saying, she's got to get him, she's got to get him. Oh, God, what are we going to do? We'll have to say something. Well, those notes can go. And then she came back. Sorry, who did you say was calling?
Oh, yes, it's William Hague.
Oh, you sound fine again now. I thought you were an imposter before. And then a gap that felt like hours. It must have only been a few seconds. And then that voice appeared. Hello? Hello, you could see the teeth in your mind's eye. Hello.
Yes, hello, Tony.
Yeah?
Yeah, well, it's William Hague. Just thought I'd phone it for a chat. Everything okay? How are you? Don't work too hard.
And this, famously, was when Tony Blair realised something was up, because Hague always, probably with a lot of, you know, Yorkshire sarcasm, never called him Tony, even though it was the time of, you know, just call me Tony. So he knew something was going on then, but he played along good-naturedly.
Right.
And then that evening, Peak Surreal, announced by Sir Trevor MacDonald, there it was on News at 10. So, wow. Yes, it 1998, February 1998, that was. Time has flown.
Yeah, amazing. Well, I mean, but that's... It's sort of interesting when you get... There's a few times you've got to play, you know, so it's you've actually got to play real people. Barry Cryer is one of them, which is... So you've played Barry in that brilliant Eric Morecambe, yes. The thing about Eddie Braben, wasn't it? That drama about him, which was excellent. How was it? Did you talk to Barry before you played Barry?
Did. Oh, I shall miss him. I shall miss him so very much. Those, as everyone has talked about, you know,
those times when the phone goes, it's old Baz Cryer. I'll leave you with this one, just the one. The most
mischievous knock-knock joke of them all.
Knock-knock, who's there? Granddad, stop the funeral.
Barry delivered these gags with just that twinkle.
Yeah.
But, oh, time in his company, what a precious thing.
Yes, it was.
What a precious thing. But, yes, it was lovely to play his part as in the Eric, Ernie and Me movie, where at this stage he was warming up for Eric and Ernie in Eddie Braben's first time of working with them.
And so there he was, and he was, you know, why is abbreviation such a long word? bless you, move about a bit. Yes, you know, one of the better, cheaper acts.
You know, all those wonderful, wonderful lines. And I think originally Barry's son, Bob Cryer, was going to play it.
Oh, yes.
But then for some reason he wasn't able to, and so I stepped in and spoke to Barry, got his
permission, got his blessing, and all that sort of thing.
And so, yeah. It was a lovely... I think I just had the right hair.
There's the number of that. And I was listening this morning on that, again, on a similar theme, to a sort of more serious thing when you did the David Bowie show about his last album, which is a really great half an hour of radio.
Yeah,
it's a sort of... And you doing him serious. I mean, you know, not that it wouldn't be... You wouldn't do so, but it's serious David Bowie...
Yes, it was... it was. I jumped at the chance to do that. It was a real honour to play... to play Bowie, but also, as you say, to play a serious narrative where you weren't just aiming for the gag. You know, a sketch is like a bank job, you know, the setup, the middle bit, and then the punchline, and you're out of there. To let the story fully flow along. And it was written by a huge David Bowie fan, David Morley, who's a very prolific radio producer, worked at Radio 1 and many stations, big David Bowie fan, and knowing his catalogue and all that information that a true fan knows. And directed by Dirk Maggs, who makes movies for radio. He's the most fantastic audio producer. And just the chance to... I was always a Bowie fan, but to go into that studying mode of listening to all of his interviews and listening to more of the music in a different frame of mind... I just ended up smitten by him, really. And I'd love the way that, you know, the way he would talk and the way he'd be thinking of ideas at the same time, and those ideas would be forming and everything like that. And just to see this mind and imagination at work. And this wonderful clip and the words have stuck with me ever since. And he said, you know, the other thing I'd say is if you feel safe in the area that you're working in, you're probably not working in the right area. Always go a little further into the water than you feel you're capable of being in. Go a little bit out of your depth. And when you feel your feet aren't quite touching the bottom, then you're just in the right place to do something exciting. And that was the first clip of his that I'd said. I thought, right, I will remember that forever.
Yeah, that's
and
great.
It was the right sort of sensibility to go in to play that part.
Do you think you might do more things like... Because it's sort of... I haven't really... I suppose you occasionally see... I mean, I suppose Coogan's doing Jimmy Savile, so it's a similar thing. But almost in radio, it's even better because it's, you know, you're not distracted by the makeup or whatever or trying to look like someone. It's just... It seems like such a great... Is there anyone you would like to do a sort of serious...
Oh, gosh,
more serious stuff about?
I do love doing these, you know, as we say, where you can let the character stretch out over a whole narrative, over a whole story. Yeah. I've done it with Alan Wicker recently.
Right.
In a drama called The Other Side of the World. And that was a wonderful way that he would speak. There was those characters that every impersonator had to do. I love the way that his voice at the end of the... each word, each syllable would have this sort of gentle way of fading off in that way, in a true broadcasting style. I'd love to play, my goodness, hoping to do Les Dawson soon, one man tribute to Les Dawson. Because I'd loved, I just loved the style and the heart to Les Dawson's writing.
Yeah.
So erudite and then the punchline comes in and like a custard pie in the face. We were so poor, the ducks used to chuck bread at us. who else? There's so many. I've enjoyed playing John Pertwee.
Yeah.
In some of the Doctor Who audio novels with Big Finish Productions. I love the great elegance of John Pertwee with that sharp resonance. But yes, so many that would be wonderful to do. Benny Hill would be fascinating to play in a biopic.
Yeah,
that's one I might stick my hand up for. And also ones that you didn't expect you'd be asked to do. In a few weeks, I'm playing Huey Green in the story of Lena Zavaroni and her career in life. So Huey Green in that is kind of a narrator, sort of an all-seeing person that the audience sees, but not the rest of the cast in the story.
Right, okay. That's
so that'll be interesting. I would never expected that to come, but
well, he's
interesting.
An interesting character. Well, all the things that come out about all sorts of... It's not as bad as some of the 70s people, but he ended up... He's Paulie Yates's dad, isn't he?
Yes, exactly, yes.
Yeah, so there's so much stuff going on with those guys. It sort of is... It's sort of fascinating, but that's what it's sort of... Because in a way, as an impressionist, you do an impression, you do John Majors, and then there's not much call for it anymore now. But, you know, when the John Majors and Edwina Curry story comes up, you're back in.
It's almost like, it's almost like you have the present time, and then there's a little orbital period, and then it comes back in a different context, in a retrospective way.
When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second-guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Wow!
Nice!
Yeah!
What you're hearing are the sounds of people everywhere putting on Bombas socks, underwear, and T-shirts made from absurdly soft materials that feel like plush clouds. Yeah, that plush. And the best part? For every item you purchase, Bombas donates another to someone facing homelessness.
Bombas. Big comfort for everyone. Go to bombas.com/ACAST and use code ACAST for 20% off your first purchase. That's bombas.com/ACAST, code ACAST.
And you, we mentioned Doctor Who, and I was going to move on to that next, actually, but you've done a lot of Doctor Who comedy stuff and also serious stuff, and you're a big Doctor Who fan, amongst everything else as
well. Oh, yes. I just love the possibilities within Doctor Who. You can travel a billion years into the future, take in the entirety of the universe, but it could also just be about that little alien butterfly that just landed there, and everything that represents. Yeah.
And you can basically, because the Tom Baker one is obviously one of your top-notch, most famous ones. But you sort of can do all. Can you do all of the Doctors, or is there any that you can't do?
Yeah, I suppose I do. I do Tom Baker, John Pertwee, and Christopher Eccleston.
Right,
they're my go-to ones. But all of the others have their phrases. William Hartnell would be, yes, one day I shall come back. Yes, one day. Until then, there must be no regrets, no tears, no anxieties. Just go forward in all your beliefs and prove to me I am not mistaken in mine. Patrick Troughton, I sort of... The era of the Five Doctors, about 1983 for him. Oh, dear. His voice had mellowed. Brigadier, I think our past might be catching up with us. Run! Yes, of course, the aforementioned Brigadier, Nicholas Courtney... Ah, yes, wonderful chap. Splendid fellow, the Doctor. All of them. Yes, and John Pertwee, I remember interviewing him once, and he said, pass me that book there. Because I'd been sort of describing how my name used to get mispronounced in school. Cauliflower and all these sorts of names. He said, pass me that book. And he read all the different mispronunciations of his name that he'd had. Jan Putrid, Master J. Peewit, Joan Plough, right there. I hope you feel better.
And then with Tom Baker, you have that... you see, it's affected my entire body language. Let me sit in a more elegant way. Yes,
he's... The endless anecdotes with Tom Baker. I've been lucky enough to record with him a few times with Big Finish Productions, in a studio in Tunbridge Wells, and his chair is there. You know, a bit like Alan Bennett class in that Hale and Pace sketch. Yes. You know, this lovely, with an antimacassar there. And he sits there telling all of these stories, you know. Yes, there was a lady, she always had an owl. She had several owls. She carried them with her. Yes, I think the owls were convinced that that she was their mother. I think she incubated the egg between her tits. And this stream of consciousness anecdotes just pour out of him. Fascinating.
Yeah, we worked with him in we did a show called Lionel Nimrod's Inexplicable World, and he was Lionel Nimrod, which was just usually introducing, and so we didn't meet him for ages, but then he kept, for the final episode, he came in, but it was just, you know, I mean, it was...
Yeah, that's the only way to express it.
I remember we had a very... Sarah Smith was our producer, who was quite... she was youngish, you know, she was sort of our age, but quite serious and austere, and she came in to the green room, just look at her, sticking her tits out. She just had to go... Oh, well, anyway, now... But, yeah, he was... and still is. Thank God, you know, I look back at that. I was thinking about it the other day, because he just turned 88 the other day. Yes. And I was just thinking, oh, so that was 30 years ago. So I'm sort of about the same age, John Baker. That's the mindfuck with all these things, yes. I think, when you suddenly go... You know, it's like back when we first went to the Light Entertainment Christmas parties, Barry Cryer would be, oh, well, there's Barry Cryer. And, you know, he would seem pretty old to us. And then you go, oh, yeah, I'm older than Barry Cryer was when he seemed old.
Yeah, that's a real... It's hard to imagine isn't it? I think Tom Baker himself said once, yes, now I'm at the stage of my career where the children who watched me now employ me.
I think there's an element of that, you know, because we was... I mean, he was absolutely my doctor. And, you know, you and me are nearly the same age. And so there was a bit of Pertwee, but then when... Yeah. And Tom Baker was there for so long and was so perfect, I think, as Doctor Who.
Yes.
But, you know, when we got the chance... You know, we couldn't believe it when he agreed to do it. And he even did it a little bit for us for... We did the Edinburgh version of it, and he recorded a bit for us for nothing as well. We didn't pay it. And he came back and we made some joke about Dick Emery, and he just came back and said, about him being dead. It was just some, like, horrible joke. And he said, I think you're better than that, boys. So he made us rewrite that line. But we went, yes, of course. But he was, you know, so generous and is so generous. I've been hoping to get him on this, but I'd really like to get him on this in front of an audience, which is a bit of a tricky proposition.
Well, I think maybe if in Tunbridge Wells, if he didn't have far to travel, he might do that. Yeah. Yes, I think so, yes.
I remember he would always do the, you know, the voiceovers on commercials, and the sound engineers would always make sure that they kept that tape running to get all the gems that he would come out with between takes. Some absolutely glorious ones. And usually he'd round off...
you know, he might have said... there's a bouncy castle for the kids open all weekends, just up Junction 9 of the M62. You know, and then he'd chuck the script away and say, there, I can make whippet shit sound like Shakespeare.
Oh, no, extraordinary. I'll ask before we forget. I mean, the thing with you, I could have like 1,000 interviews. I could just get you to... be different people. I will try and do these as you. I think I was thinking I could ask you to answer other things. But before we do a couple of emergency questions, I found it's interesting with impressionists. It's quite hard to get to them,
right.
The person of them. Right? I've found that a lot. I mean, Steve Coogan, who I know quite well, and I've worked with a lot, but I don't feel I know him very well. It's sort of like the voices of sometimes, and Mike Yard would very much have. This is me.
Yes.
Is there an element of that? Do you feel that the voices are sort of like it's a protective shield, protecting yourself as a person, as an individual?
I suppose it's partly a party trick, just to keep things chirpy and interesting.
Yeah.
You know, if I could tap dance, I'd probably do that at regular intervals. I think perhaps there's a subconscious thing of that's slightly what people expect you to do, especially in a professional setting. But yes, to speak as your own self as well, it's actually quite nice when you get a chance to get to that.
Well, it is nice, but you know, like, I think I always think ventriloquists, they all turned out to be perverts, and now I'm a ventriloquist, I'm a bit worried about it. There's because even like someone like Sellers, who obviously was an amazing, you know, actor but voice guy as well, and it felt like there were layers and layers and layers. And I'm talking to you about it because I don't think this is true of you, but it just sometimes it felt like you would get to the middle and then was there any Peter Sellers in the middle anymore? You know, were the characters so big? Steve Coogan is, you know, who is the real Steve Coogan? Yes. It's very hard to get to him. I guess because it's partly because people expect it, and it's partly because it's an easy way, isn't it, to socialise and be funny and
yes, people. It's just your own way of being chirpy. Peter Sellers, who you mentioned, a character there of immense complexity.
Yeah.
Immense. The way he was wired and immense complexity there.
Yeah. Are you immensely complex?
Oh, I don't think so. No. It'd be lovely if I was. I'm quite mellow and placid, really.
Yeah.
Quite, you know, unassuming.
But maybe there has to be. Maybe there has to be an element of that for all the stuff to go on to the top of that. You know what I mean? Maybe there has to be. If you're a big character, and your personality is that big personality, then maybe it's harder to build the stuff or to take it down and build it up again. You know.
Yes, I suppose I'm a blank canvas in a sense.
That's what I wanted to say.
Yes,
I see you as a sort of blank. Let's find out more about John Coleshaw. Without any impressions to fall back on. I bet you can get something.
Oh, this is interesting.
Have you ever been in a police car, John Coleshaw?
Yes, in an episode of Heartbeat. I think I have. Yes, on Red Rose Radio when I was 19, and I used to do the travel reports.
Yeah.
I once sort of did a feature from inside a police car, and they were talking about the equipment and how they communicate with their colleagues and keep the roads ticking over. I have been in a police car.
I was arrested for murder. I got away with it.
I was driving home for Christmas. Should be a song about that. And I was just, you know, toddling along, you know, I'd just gone onto the M6. And all of a sudden, three police cars surrounded me, boxed in, with the blue lights on. And, you know, in my a sense of John LeMessurier came over me. That is very regular. I wonder what this could be. I suppose I'd better stop, really. So I stopped, and then these police got out of the car like Imperial stormtroopers. You could almost hear the walking across. And would you step out of the car, please? Would you get into this car here? I was thinking, what on earth has gone on here? And they said, this car with this number plate has been reported stolen and been used in a hit-and-run accident, several hit-and-run accidents.
Oh, God.
I thought, my goodness, what's gone on? And then it occurred to me, my number plates had been stolen a few weeks before.
Oh, okay.
And I was getting parking tickets that I'd had nothing to do with. And so I explained to them that this is what it was, and I'd reported the crime at this police station, and they checked it up, and it tallied. And then they were very apologetic and let me go and said Merry Christmas.
I was just doing an impression of a hit and driver.
I didn't even get on police camera action or nothing like that.
Talking about that, there was one thing on Wikipedia that I just wanted to ask a question about, that you sat for impressionist artist Cherie Valentine Daines. Was she an impressionist artist or an impressionist artist?
That's a very good question. Maybe there was a combination of the two universes right there. Yes, I did. I did. I was.
Do you remember it?
I was sat there just trying to keep comfortable and keep awake. And she was like this, and she had a sort of a Tony Hart quality about her.
Yeah.
Yes, and there I was in this sort of dappled sort of way. Okay.
And it wasn't just, you just doesn't go around all the impressionists. There's Deborah Stevenson.
Well, yes.
Steve Coogan.
This would be a good little book, I think. I think it was at the opening of an art shop.
Okay.
And I was doing a bit of a turn just to say it, we're open sort of thing.
Okay.
And leading up to that, the idea was for me to sit there and be painted.
which was rather a pleasure.
Very good. All right, I'll ask you another emergency question. Let's try something. If all the museums and art galleries in the world got together and said, we love your impressions and we've all decided you can have one thing from one of the museums and art galleries in the world and you can keep it, what piece of art or, you know, thing from a museum, artefact from a museum would you like to possess?
Wow.
Yeah.
Oh, there's a great question. My brain is working like a Google search engine to try and find something. I think it might be... See, I've gone into David Attenborough now because it suits what we're going to say. I think it might be the skeleton in the Natural History Museum of a Glyptodon.
Okay.
Which was sort of part Ankylosaurus, part pangolin, part armadillo, but from prehistoric times.
Right.
And it's a strange thing, like a great spherical rhinoceros.
Okay.
And I'm always fascinated by the idea that these creatures lived and existed and roamed the earth. And I'd love to time travel back to the late Cretaceous and just have a very cautious look at the majesty of these creatures.
Yeah.
The Glyptodon was one of the mammals from about 30 million years ago. I think the Oligocene period, alongside the Androsarcus and the Entelodont. See, I retain these silly little words, you see. But yes, I think the Glyptodon from the Natural History Museum.
No one else has chosen that, I can tell you that. And you seem to have you've got an incredible memory. Because you remember everyone's names. I've noticed this in all the interviews. You remember the name of the girl from the reception.
And, yes,
but, you know,
yes.
You seem to remember everyone's names, which is very impressive. But to remember those sort of technical details, do you think is there something about your this sponge retaining lots and lots of information about everything that you can sort of draw on? Because you sort of need to, if you're going to sort of improvise as you do with your impressions as well, you need to have the arsenal there, right, to use the right terms and stuff.
Yes, I think I do like to retain random bits of fascination.
Yeah.
Like that. I'll never know quite what it might be. But certain things that just appeal in a quirky, eccentric way, I like to collect those things.
Yeah.
And I often find that they are there in odd precision.
It's good. I mean, I think a lot of comedians are. I mean, the comedians sort of have to... You know, certainly as a stand-up comedian, you sort of... And if you're doing any audience work, you sort of need to... have at least a bit of information about almost everything. So I think that's why I think a lot of comedians... And I know you've done... I love all the TV quizzes, and I've done lots of the TV quizzes, and I know you have as well. And that's why why comedians do quite well on those shows. How have you done? You've done pretty much all of them as I have.
Yes.
Have you won everything? Did you win the chase?
Yeah, we won the chase. We won the...
How much money did you make on the chase?
100 grand.
150 grand.
Yes.
Between 50 grand each.
I don't know if you noticed this on your episode of The Chase, but when we'd won the total, it was just by a little margin, but no, we'd won the 100 grand. And just off somewhere, we heard the voice of the producer saying, oh, bloody hell. Going to have to repeat this one for bloody years now.
Yeah. You've done all. You've done Pointless.
Pointless. I've done Pointless four times. Actually,
I've done it four times. How many times have you won it?
One.
I've only won one as well.
Yeah, the first time.
Last time, I had three failures before we won.
Oh, it was. I was my teammates. I'm blaming my teammates.
Yeah,
now,
I blame my teammates.
It was their fault. Not they said the incorrect ones, and we were there just to mop up afterwards. But I do love Pointless, the teamwork between Alexandra and Richard Osman. Celebrity Mastermind I've done.
Yeah.
Done that a couple of times. Come second on that each time.
I came second. That's
it's really annoying, isn't it?
It is. I came second before the person who followed me was the highest total that the Celebrity Mastermind had, and then it was beaten 2 minutes later, so I didn't...
Yeah.
That's more annoying, John.
It's annoying, yeah.
I had my hand on the trophy.
Yes. It's that skill of quizzing, isn't it, to... When you start missing a few, to not get distracted.
Yeah.
And almost not hear the next question.
Well, Mastermind, that exactly had that. There was, and it's sort of weird the way your brain suddenly... There was a question about gladiators, but the answer was gladiator. It was about what Roman, soldier or whatever is named after a flower, but the words all started flying around, and I couldn't even think of the word gladiator, but I think I was trying to go for something cleverer than gladiator,
And then, at the beginning of it, and then I missed the flower and everything. And then the next question, I realised halfway through the question, I was still thinking about the Gladiator one. I did manage to answer it somehow, but I hadn't heard half of the question because I was off.
It's so true, isn't it? Yeah. Your thoughts mix up, and it's quite distracting, the whole setting of a quiz on the telly like that. It's quite distracting. You doubt your own name in some moments.
Well, it's because I think also with Mastermind, we've watched that for whatever, most of our lives, all of our lives probably, and that walk up to the chair and everything, it is, it's imbued with this fear. It's lovely to get to do all of these shows, I have to say. It's one of my favourite things about being slightly famous, that I can get to go. It's the only way to go on TV now is to go on Pointless. But I actually just... Have you done House of Games? You'd be great on House of Games.
I'm doing that in March.
Oh, yeah.
I'm looking forward to that.
It's really good fun, but it's all done in a day. So it's, five shows in a day. And that's one where there was a moment in that where I knew the answer to something, and then suddenly it was 5 minutes later and I missed the show. Someone else's one came in, and I realised we were three questions. I just zoned out, because you're doing... That was by Thursday. Mm. You've done three shows already, and then it's this very intense. And by Thursday, 2 o'clock in the afternoon, your brain starts. You leave your body behind. Come like,
that's good advice, actually, Richard. I'll keep that. I'll keep that knowledge for when I do it. Just keep the attention.
Yeah, I think
going.
After lunch. I think we do episode four after lunch, and just I don't know. Take some kind of drugs that will wake you up. Take some cocaine with you.
It's such a relaxed collegiate show, isn't it? That you need
but
these
it's,
things.
You know, it's very. I really love it. And I love Osman. I think he's just sort of awesome at everything he does. He's very rude to me. He's been on my show a few times. He's very rude. He's rude about my mum.
He sort of does it with love, though, doesn't he?
Yeah.
He does it in a certain way, which is
But you're great, really.
He's good. He's good. He's a good kid. So I was very interested, actually, as well. I think I may have seen this show, but I can't remember if I did. But where you actually was it called Alter Egos?
Where you
interview people as themselves. It's just such a great idea.
Yes.
Who did you do on that show, and how did people respond?
I think a pal of mine who produced a lot of those, Richard Lewis, may even be here today. Yes, memories of Who Wants to Be a Millionaire there with the cops going on. That was enormous fun to do. It was interesting, the people who chose to do it.
Right.
Big personalities chose to do it. Chris Tarrant was one of those, and I remember how he was sitting even to this. Ha, 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 tee hee, nothing like me. And then Patrick Moore. I think in another universe, Patrick Moore would have been a vaudeville entertainer, and there he was, and we were arguing about cricket and everything like that. Who else did we have? The wonderful Dale Winton.
Oh, great.
Dear Dale, with that lovely voice there, that wonderful, smooth, dancing voice like that. It was...
I mean, the pressure's really on, though, for you as an impressionist, if you're talking, so your impression is up against the actual person.
Well, it's great, you can directly copy it.
Yes.
You can tune right into it. And you think, right, that's where you are. Okay, you're doing that, I'll do that with my leg, I'll do that. And you can get into this mirror imaging. And afterwards, it was a thing that I did on other shows.
Right.
I did the same with Ozzy Osbourne on an episode of Parkinson, which was... me and Ozzy Osbourne did a margarine advert together once, and he was looking there, he was looking at, the I Can't Believe It's Not Butter, and he said, it's like fucking yellow axle grease, this. And he'd say, what's that word there? How would I say it? Polyunsaturates.
And also, where else did I do that alter ego thing? I think with Parkinson. I think I interviewed Parkinson as Parkinson. Except I was the Parkinson from the 1970s, and he was in his present day form, and we were sort of comparing time zones, you see. And it was in a few weeks I've got a wonderful interview coming up with a very good entertainer, actually, Rod Hull, an emu. Oh, have you? Oh well. you'll enjoy that. Yes, I bet I will. This fellow with the crazy hair and his awkward bird. All right. If you think that's an awkward bird, wait until you meet Meg Ryan.
It's such a good... I mean, I just think... can't see why that isn't on TV every week. I think it's such a good idea. It feels like you could do it as a podcast, maybe, and be in control of yourself. Because I think just that ability to do the autobiography, that's even better, you know, if it's a different time zone and one of you knows stuff that the other doesn't know. That's a really fascinating concept, I think.
Yes, maybe worth a revisit there.
Yeah, I think it is.
Maybe worth a revisit. Yeah, the different time zones, as you say.
Yeah.
So they've got something to compare.
Because I think it's, you know, it's the imagination, you know, because it's this core skill and it's really impressive. And then to be able to do all these different things with it, and some people just fall back and, you know, I think in the past especially, I suppose Mike Yarwood sort of was almost the first person to do it, possibly was he, or certainly in. To the degree he did.
Yeah, certainly. His first big-time Saturday Night TV impersonator,
And then I think a lot of people just sort of copied him for a while, and then it's finding your own way. Which obviously, Dead Ringers, which, I mean, it's been going for a good long time now. It's been on and off, has it?
22 years it's been going. Yeah, 22 years.
So that's, I mean, that's, you've sort of found your own way with that, with the team. The team's changed a little bit over the time, right? But it's...
Yes, that there's Tom Jameson and Nev Fountain, the core writers, are still there. Lawrence Howarth, the script editor. But new writers do keep coming and going. Bill Dare, the producer, he's very much a mentor of new writers. And he will bring them in. And I think Bill has got this idea. He knows the sense of how Dead Ringers, it's sort of got its own attitude towards things.
Yeah.
It's got its own sensibility and tone, a sort of an impudent sense somewhere between Private Eye and the Beano, perhaps. But it's got an attitude of its own, and it's that over the top of the gags. And place that on Radio 4, which is ever so well-behaved.
Yes.
And the sense, there's a little rebellious, naughty sense.
I think that's right, because I was listening to that in the car on the way here, and I've heard it many times before, obviously, as well, but... I recognise some of the younger writers. Think, oh, that's good. They've got them in. That's a good person to have in. But I when I moved to London and started writing, I was writing for Weekending, which was a bit of a. I mean, it'd been going for a long time, probably longer than Dead Ringers has gone at that stage. And it had got into a bit of a rut, and I didn't like writing for it. I have to say, it got a bit too formulaic. But it did feel, listening to Dead Ringers, that, you know, it feels fresh and it feels like. You know, there's the people who've been writing forever, but there's new people coming in. And that is exactly what I thought. It felt like a fun show to be asked to work on, you know, as a young writer especially.
Yes, it's the way I get the news. I would much rather get the news from reading a Dead Ringers script than watching the endless news of and social media and everywhere. It's a lovely way to get it. But they've got that wonderful skill, the writers, and it's particularly... pertinent with Boris Johnson, because if you just sort of make him the clown and bumbling around, you're sort of helping him in a way. So that the writers they're very incisive and they really stick the facts. That side of the writing for Boris Johnson is really high in the mix now.
It feels, though, as well that, I mean, there seemed to be a period, and maybe starting with John Major, where things have become a bit boring with. Politicians, or there was a lot of faceless politicians who weren't that interesting to do or were more difficult to do impressions with. But it feels like over the last 4 or 5 years as the world has imploded that you have a lot more material of amazing characters to work with.
Absolutely. It's gone a bit like that. You know, these things run in biorhythms. When John Major had his time,
you know, Tony Blair had come in. That really set a brand new rhythm and tone, no pun intended, altogether.
That really reflected through on the writing. Gordon Brown, equally characterful, but in a different sort of way. And there he was with that interesting jaw-dropping action at the end of every word. He's sort of seen as an elder statesman now. People look at him with this reverence now. And then David Cameron comes in, very bland, very anodyne. Not much going on apart from, you know, just a repeated hand gesture, generic posh, and wanting to sort of go away and get out of the interview as soon as possible. Although Duncan Wisbew does Cameron on Dead Ringers, he's found a certain little slither in his character. Yes. It just comes out. And in he had a great, great line as David Cameron in the... Brexit referendum show that we did, and it goes, you see, I only call this referendum because it never occurred to me that I might lose. That's the kind of arrogant, entitled bell-end I really am.
Duncan delivers that beautifully.
Really, nice, really great. It's very hard it's very hard to work out which of them is really to blame for everything that's happened. But I think Cameron probably, you know, when you look, the terrible thing about Cameron is just that he slithered off. He was very snake-like. He fucked up and then just went, bye! Disappeared into his little shed to write his books, didn't he?
So let's wait for Strictly to call.
But, so Trump and... I mean, does it feel like a gift to have Trump and Johnson, or does it feel like the real world weighs down and you think, I'd rather not have a good voice to do?
It's a gift in terms of that they were sort... You know, if the Cameron era had left us feeling a bit short of characters to latch on to...
Yeah.
Trump and Boris Johnson felt like great quantitative easing. Dropped in... like two Olympic-sized pool dollops of rancid blancmange. There you are. Work with that. The Donald, I suppose you could have something about... I think we developed a certain way of doing the Donald where it was kind of nice if you could just get by with gestures and not have to talk as him. That's his Las Vegas neon, isn't it?
It almost feels, though, with Johnson and Trump, that they have almost looked and thought, how can I do a comedy caricature of a politician, and how can I, you know? But they're so exaggerated themselves as people, and you certainly feel with Johnson that was a deliberate thing, and I think probably with Trump as well. I can turn into this caricature, people find me funny. It sort of does. The people who find me funny and don't like me, it's still they're finding me funny, and I get something from that. And the people who, like arrogant bellends for some reason, think I want the most arrogant bloke who cares most about himself more than anyone else, and 50% of us are going to vote for him, whatever he does.
It's the greatest sort of self-manufactured shield and gimmick that you could have. If you can be someone who no one ever expects you to behave in any serious way, no one expects you to say a serious word in any kind of way. Sometimes I try to look as though I give a monkey's about the job I'm doing, but most of the time I even fail in that too.
But then there's no... That's what's just sort of fascinating about them, is as long as they don't... if they don't feel shame... and they won't back away, they can stay in for as long as they want. You know, Trump almost managed to work a way of losing an election and staying. And I think he'll be back. I do think he'll...
I think it's interesting to watch. I think that gimmick is running out for Boris Johnson now. Yeah. It's interesting to watch this, the oxygen supply of that gimmick just gradually ebbing away.
We'll see. I didn't know this. I missed this, but you got to number 22 in the pop charts.
Oh, yeah.
A couple of years ago.
Yeah, well, it was a couple of weeks ago. Yes, I thought that I would write a Christmas record specifically. This was the appeal of the idea, specifically to cover the funny week between Christmas and New Year.
Yeah.
Because it occurred to me that there wasn't anything for that funny period of time. So I got together with a couple of friends, a brilliant musician called Michael Bannister, who's played with Texas and other bands, and I'd written this song, sort of channeled Chaz and Dave and and a bit of Status Quo. And we came up with it. And I was interviewed by Chris Moyles, and the thing went to 22 in the iTunes chart.
Pretty good.
And then it went out again.
There might be a reason why no one's written songs about that particular week before.
Yeah, I suppose. It was all about, lazy sofa days and people queuing up shopping and it's making the news and kind of that. It was inspired by watching Chaz and Dave's Christmas Knees Up.
Right.
On Channel 5. And I thought, we need a song like that for this funny week. But we'll give it another run next year and see.
Yeah. I always find that it is it's the perineum, a lot of people call that, so there was a better one than that someone came up with. It was more Christmassy. I feel sorry for the people who die in the last week of the year because they usually miss. I think Betty White was one this year, but you miss out on the looking back at the year and then you're not in the next one. So you die in that week.
I mean, Betty White was big enough, I think, to overcome the hand dying at that particular time. Is this true? I saw this. I don't know where I saw this, but are you going to be playing Jeff Tracy in Thunderbirds, or have you done that?
Oh yes, I do that in the audio Thunderbirds.
Wow. Okay. Yeah.
I do. I play. Yes.
Stand by for action. Yes, the wonderful voice of Jeff Tracy, superbly created by Peter Dinley back in the day, and it's one of those where you can be very heroic. That's right, son. Thunderbird 3, engage. Stand by for action. Thunderbirds are go. But it's quite interesting if you relax even a little bit. It's not too far before you'll probably come to rest at Sir Terry Wogan. Yes, you do, and you've got to mouth in Virgil. I think you should. Don't let that fiend, the Hood, get away with scuppering another of our missions, you know.
This is something, I think, obviously, when you're in that world and when you're doing voices, and it's seeing those voices that no one else would notice are similar, and it's an amazing thing when it's demonstrated. I've seen you do that a few voices. Have you got, what are your favourite close voices?
The voice neighbours thing. I love it when there's a big contrast.
Yeah.
I think quite an enduring one. I think it might be Russell Crowe. I think it might be Russell Crowe in his movie mode. Gladiator, he would be in this sort of manner. Master and Commander, if he's on, the Graham Norton show, he'll be a little bit more relaxed and become, a bit of a stroppy, pug-faced, pugnacious individual in that sort of way. But I've always thought if you took the gruffness of Russell Crowe and just gave it a Lancashire edge, then you would get Les Dawson. My name is Maximus Decimus Meridius. I shall return to these ramparts this very evening. I shall bring Gracchus and Proximo, and I shall kill Commodus, because he's a barn pot.
And you still took, you did a tour show with Bill Dare, wasn't
it?
Which was the Great British Takeoff. Is that an ongoing thing? Because I know you toured with it quite extensively.
Yeah, we did about 4 years of that. We'll probably do some more due course.
Is it an improvised thing?
It's just like this.
Yeah.
It's just like this. And it's a conversation on that will tee me off into remembering various anecdotes or various characters.
Yeah.
A little bit biographical. Bill sort of steers through, from those early days of Spitting Image and working at Park Motors in Ormskirk cleaning cars and listening to the Radio 1 Roadshow, thinking, that sounds like an interesting job, I'll take my aim there. So, yes, it's quite improvised, but a bit biographical as well.
Cool, that's great. And what's going to be coming up in the future? Have you got anything exciting planned, or are you...?
Yes, I've got some more Doctor Who audio stories coming up with Big Finish Productions. Playing Huey Green in the Tim Whitnall play Lena, that's in March, and in Edinburgh this year. That's what I'm hoping to do. My one-man play tribute to a very splendid fellow who may or may not sound a little bit like
this. Oh, great. Well, it'd be interesting to see. I'm not sure whether what I'm doing with Edinburgh this, but I think I've heard it's going to be every single comedian in the country is going to be up there. So I think it'll be a big celebration of getting back, hopefully, getting back to some kind of normality. Did you find the lockdown time difficult? Were you not being able to get out, or were you doing lots of things?
It was just a time to adapt, wasn't it, really? Just embrace the simplicity for a time. Everything went on to Zoom, didn't it?
Yeah.
Sort of a comedy gig that you might do in a live space would go onto Zoom and become a charity sort of interview, a bespoke little TV piece rather than a live show for the organisation involved. So, it was just a case of adapting to this new sort of two-dimensional zone and making out what you can, the best you can with it. But yes, I suppose I enjoyed the simplicity and the chance to pause for a little while
Just gather your thoughts.
Yeah, I think there was lots. I mean, it'd be really interesting to see what the Edinburgh Fringe is like this year. There was one last year, but it was just a few people who went up, and I think it sounded like it was a bit like the early days of the Fringe. It was a bit more kind of crazy and people trying stuff out, and far fewer acts up there. So I think this year it might just be back to being an unwieldy amount of people. But
We'll be ready for it. Yeah. Won't we by that time? We'll be ready for it.
And have you done the Fringe a fair amount before, right?
Yes, I've done the Great British Takeoff show there a couple of times. We've done Dead Ringers live there a few times. I remember my earliest memories of it was simply just travelling up with Radio 4 and recording a live version of a show there, either Dead Ringers or First Impressions or And This Is Them, some of those panel shows.
Yeah.
Lovely to go and do that in Edinburgh.
Yeah, it's great fun. Well, look, it's been really fantastic to talk to you, and there's so much we could have talked about, and we've got through lots of it, so that is absolutely fantastic. Ladies and gentlemen, please give a massive round of applause to the amazing John Coleshaw. Well done. Well done.
Thank you so much.
Very good.
Thank you.
Thank you very much, everyone. Have a good night. You have been listening to Rahalastapa with me, Richard Herring, and my guest, John Coleshaw. Thank you very much to the Bristol Slapstick Festival, everyone there, Chris Daniels, and all the people who looked after my children over this weekend while my wife, Katie Wilkins, had COVID, so was at home. I'm indebted to my director and producer and friend, Chris Evans, not that one, and also to everyone at St. George's for having us during this lovely recording. This is a Sky Potato Fuzz and GoFasterStrike.com production for the internet. Go to richardherring.com/gigs for all information about upcoming shows. Please come and see us live, or gfsboxoffice.com for live streaming. Thank you very much. Goodbye.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Mm. HelloFresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news! Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free, or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to Quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Thanks very much for listening to the podcast. Go to GoFasterStripe.com for fantastic downloads and books, and to join the Go Faster Stripe Club and get loads of stuff from really interesting comedians. Help little Chris Evans knock that one out. That would be lovely. All right, RichardHerring.com for all my gigs. Hope to see you at a gig. Come and say hi after if you've enjoyed these podcasts. Don't come if you haven't enjoyed them and say you haven't enjoyed them. It'll make me feel sad.